Here. Okay, so thanks, Jamie, for organizing this panel, which I think the title is Clinically Practicable Biomarkers, and I'm going to mention that because it's sort of a theme that's going to thread through this talk. So I'm going to talk about our work in high-risk infants, both in infants of familial risk, meaning baby SIBs, as well as tuberous sclerosis. I always start with my acknowledgement slide because sometimes I run long. Just want to say that the work I'm going to talk about today is really a family effort with many, many people in the lab, and I'll actually highlight folks as we talk about some data. Particularly want to acknowledge Morella DiPreto, who's my co-PI in the baby SIB study, and then Chuck Nelson, who's the PI of the co-PI of our work in TSC. Okay, these are just my disclosures. So I'm going to spend about 5 minutes giving you just an overall framework for how we think about clinical biomarkers in high-risk infants, and then give you some sort of snippets of data in two studies, one in infant siblings and one in tuberous sclerosis. So I first want to just think about, like, how do we study high-risk infants, right? Or how do we think about infants at risk? And as you know, most of the work that's been done over the last decade or so has been in infants of high familial risk because they have an older sibling with autism, right? And that certainly represents a very important proportion of infants with risk. But there are other populations we can study, such as the general population as our prevalence rates increase, right? So that we can think about studying the general population. Of course, when we study those babies, we have to think about biomarkers that are more scalable, right, and that are able to be implemented in the community because we're studying a lot of babies who won't actually develop atypically, right? We can think about environmental risks. When I say that, I mean any infant that doesn't have a genetic predisposition. So in NICU graduates, babies with prematurity, infants with prenatal drug exposure, right? Those are actually a very interesting population that probably hasn't been studied enough, in part because there's challenges. There's a lot of heterogeneity in that group, right? But I think it's, again, important to think about that as a potential group to study. And then we have our genetic syndromes, right? And tuberous sclerosis is one that we've been studying in part because they're diagnosed very early and we can follow them from early infancy. But there's many genetic syndromes that are highly penetrant for autism, which gives us a really nice opportunity to study mechanism and also specific symptoms within these high-risk groups. The negative is that they're rare, and so we're studying very small samples, as you'll see with our TSC work. And so I think it's important just to think about high-risk in multiple ways so that we can actually design and define our biomarker study appropriately. Okay, so what we know from mostly our work in infant siblings, and this is based on lots of work from the Baby SIBS Research Consortium, is that basically behavioral signs of autism emerge in the second year of life. Of course, there's been beautiful studies in eye tracking and other areas that have shown some, you know, markers in the first year, but really we think behavioral symptoms start emerging in the second year of life, right? But what we know about brain development, again, I'm summarizing a huge field in one slide, is that, you know, we know that there's disruptions in brain development that are occurring much earlier in autism, right? And these are disruptions in basic systems like cortical organization and brain growth. And there's some nice papers recently showing brain overgrowth in infants at risk for autism, disruptions in connectivity, and disruptions in excitation and inhibition balance, right? And so these are, again, mechanisms that are at play incredibly early, well before behavioral symptoms emerge. Right? And so based on that knowledge, I would sort of propose, and I think many of us in the room would agree, that we should be able to identify and develop clinically practicable biomarkers in early infancy based on our knowledge of brain development. So what kinds of features do these biomarkers need to have? Well, we'd like them to be predictive of some sort of outcome, right? Either atypical development or specifically autism, or at least we want them to be predictive of risk. Because if we can start identifying risk markers, we might think about, you know, employing interventions even before we know what the diagnosis is going to be, right, just to start to modify development. We also would like these biomarkers to be rooted in mechanism, right? We want to have some hypothesis about what we're studying based on what we know about brain development, right? So we're not just sort of casting a very wide net. We'd like these biomarkers to be easy to measure across developmental populations and risk groups. So even infants with profound delays or impairments or with cortical pathology, right? I'm hinting at TSC. We'd like measures that actually are able to measure these phenomenon across different groups. And then this is more of a question. Would we like biomarkers that are modifiable, right? Do we want markers that might be measures of target engagement of a drug or an outcome of intervention? So do we want markers of brain function or development that actually might be sensitive to change, right, particularly with an intervention? And that's something that I think we've been thinking about quite a bit as a field. And so in this context, I would sort of propose that one of the tools that we really can use that actually I think hits at a lot of those different elements we talked about is EEG, right? Because EEG, or electroencephalography, is a scalable, developmentally feasible tool that directly measures neural activity, circuit formation, and neural function really early in infancy. And there's a rich literature on electrophysiological changes that occur in typical development. So we can borrow from that to study atypical development. And what we can do with that EEG signal overall, and again, I'm reducing this down to a few slides just to kind of give you some concepts, is that we can take that EEG signal and break it into sort of these component parts of this power spectrum, right? To sort of think about what do these different oscillatory bands do and how do we quantify them, right? And we know that these different oscillatory bands, such as theta and alpha and beta that are defined by the frequency in which they sit, really have specific physiological properties. And we can do things like measure just power, which gives us a good measure of neural synchrony, right? We can measure connectivity through measures like coherence, and we can measure things like signal complexity. So based on that, I'd say in our research program, our overarching aims are to identify EEG patterns that might precede or underlie the impairments that we see in autism. And we'd like to use methods that are scalable and are rooted in mechanism. And our overarching hypothesis, again, across all these studies is that we really should be able to identify differences in the first year of life, right? Particularly in EEG power and connectivity. And we hope that these would actually map onto autism symptomatology. So I'm now going to give you a little bit of, sort of show you some data and two sets of studies that we have. And again, the goal here is to sort of give you a sense of the principles, right, of how we're thinking about these populations and hopefully get you excited about kind of future work. Our first sort of line of research is in familial risk, and this is Morella DiPreto here, who's my partner in crime in this work. And we have a baby sib study at UCLA as part of our Autism Center of Excellence. In that study, we enriched our high-risk sample with multiplex infants, so infants who have more than one sibling with autism, and we collect sleep, fMRI, as well as EEG in the first year of life. And we really have a very sort of biomarker-heavy first year of life, and then we look at outcomes. I'm just going to show you the EEG data, and I'll just say that we're still in that study, so our outcomes are really 18-month outcomes based on the ADOS toddler module and their risk stratification based on that. Okay, and I won't go into too much detail here, but we use the EGI system. We have a high-density electrode array. The resting EEG is collected while babies are actually just watching bubbles that are blown from behind a curtain, so there's no human being to make it social. And then we have a very extensive processing pipeline with cleaning so that we can really feel secure that what we're analyzing is not noise but actually brain activity. And then we analyze the data at first just in the frequency domain to investigate power in the different frequency bands that I mentioned. And I'm just going to show you our pertinent findings actually here, which is that our main finding is that we see differences by risk group in particularly alpha power, both whole brain and occipital alpha. And you can see that here in these, I don't know if there's a pointer. Okay, you can see that the red line is high risk and the blue line is low risk. We particularly see a differentiation starting at 9 and 12 months. But we were quite interested actually in then looking at babies based on symptomatology. So we were divided them up into ADOS concern and no concern. And I will highlight that one of the babies in the ADOS concern group is a low risk control. And what we see there is really a differentiation where our infants who are showing symptoms on the ADOS toddler module are really differentiating based on whole brain alpha and occipital alpha at 9 and 12 months. So you see here differences not only in trajectory but also in cross-sectional power. Based on that alpha finding, we really have been interested in sort of looking at connectivity and particularly phase coherence in the alpha range. And Abby Dickinson, who's a postdoc in my lab, who's a signal processor extraordinaire, had a poster on this actually yesterday, but she actually did a very large study examining alpha phase coherence in children with autism. And what we did was we took basically a data-driven approach to and took very conservative measures with our statistics to identify which networks are significant different between typically developing children and those with autism. And what I will say is that what we found was that the big differences were in interhemispheric connections, right, which is very consistent with some of the literature already, right, where we could differentiate ASD and TD based on alpha phase coherence interhemispherically. So in our smaller sample of our baby sibs, what we did was we just looked at interhemispheric connectivity and phase coherence based on this work. And what we find is that we really don't differentiate risk groups based on alpha phase coherence, and this is just interhemispheric coherence, but we do differentiate concerns groups. And what we find is that the babies who are showing evidence of autism symptoms show a really rapid increase in this interhemispheric coherence and then a pretty rapid decline over 6 to 12 months of age. So a difference, again, cross-sectionally, particularly at 6 months, and then a difference in slope over that over the second part of the first year of life. Okay, I'm going to sort of pull it all together at the end, but I'm actually going to go on to talking about very similar work in another high-risk group, which is tuberous sclerosis. And here you can see Candace Varson, who's done a lot of this work, and she's now in Australia, and Chuck Nelson, who was too busy actually testing subjects and kids to take a headshot. So here he is actually, you know, collecting developmental data in our study. Tuberous sclerosis is, as many of you probably know, an autosomal dominant disorder, characterized by benign hamartomas in both the brain and body, and it's incredibly penetrant for autism, right, with rates of autism up to 50 to 60%. I have this little image up here from a paper we recently published that actually showed that our toddlers with TSC that we've been following prospectively have incredible symptom convergence with non-syndromic autism. So these kids really have autism. So on the ADOS, you really can't differentiate their symptoms from children with non-syndromic ASD. But what's also really important about TSC is these babies are often diagnosed in utero. And this is a picture of a cardiac rhabdomyoma that's seen on an ultrasound. So these babies are diagnosed before birth. So that provides us a really nice opportunity to study the emergence of atypical development in these babies. Moreover, from a neurobiological perspective, very consistent with what we've talked about already, TSC has been coined a synaptopathy, right? So these children have been shown, and this is sort of in cross-sectional studies in older ages, have been shown to have aberrant connectivity and white matter development, particularly actually have been shown to have delays in white matter development and myelination, which has led to some studies showing some reduced interhemispheric connectivity, again, in older individuals with TSC. And so we've had a study of early development in TSC. This study actually recently finished, and so we've published a lot of the behavioral data already and are now kind of plowing through our electrophysiological data. We started out with 40 infants with tuberous sclerosis that we mostly started following at 9 months of age, just because of recruitment and other issues. And we followed them through 36 months and then actually performed diagnostics at 36 months, right, to look at autism outcomes as well as cognitive and other developmental domains. What I want to highlight from this slide is that 18 of our infants developed autism and 22 did not, so consistent with that 50% rate. And again, much of this has already been published. But I also want to highlight all of our children had cortical pathology. They all had tubers, and 38 of the 40 had epilepsy. And we did not find any clinical differences between ASD and no ASD, right? So even our non-autism group has epilepsy, they have cortical pathology, just like we see in TSC as a whole. And that's important when I show you our EEG data. So I'm going to show you just one developmental slide. Again, I didn't want to make too much of this because it's already been published. But what we found, and I wish I had a pointer, is that, I do actually. Let's see. I don't want to waste time on this one. So what we find, can you even see this? I can't see it either. It's okay. I'll just point in that direction. What we find, purple is TSC and autism, is that starting at 12 months, our autism group has significantly lower verbal and nonverbal developmental quotient scores. So we'll just call it, you know, cognitive scores based on the Mullen. And there's a difference in trajectory where there's a divergence from typical in our kids with autism. And so we're seeing behavioral and developmental differences in the infants who go on to have autism. Recently, what we found in this paper will hopefully be out soon is that by 9 months, even a social communication measure like the Autism Observational Scale of Infancy, the AOC, is differentiating the infants who go on to have autism. So we actually have behavioral measures that are sensitive to an autism diagnosis in this group that's highly penetrant, if you will, for autism. So that's kind of a nice finding just to kind of emphasize that we don't need only biomarkers, right, in these kinds of groups. Like, behavior actually is pretty powerful here. But we did want to actually examine their electrophysiological profiles as well, just like we did with our baby SIBs. And so first, I'm just showing you a power spectral density plot. And what I want to emphasize here is just the fact that the lines overlap a lot. And that may sound silly, but the reality is that despite the fact that these infants have tubers, they have epilepsy, they're on medications, we actually see a really nice power spectrum in all of our infants, even the ones who go on to have autism. But you might, some of you, the EEG folks in the room, might notice some differences. And they do actually pan out. So what we find in TSC, unlike in our baby SIBs, is that alpha power is significantly lower in our infants with TSC across the ages. And it actually alpha differentiates our autism and non-autism group starting at 24 months, right? So we are seeing a pattern of difference in alpha power in these infants. And alpha power actually in this group is associated with cognitive function. So lower alpha is associated with lower cognitive abilities. And this was actually a poster that Candace had yesterday. And then finally, when we then examine alpha phase coherence, the same thing, inner hemispheric connectivity, we find a really interesting pattern, right? So we see also increased coherence at 9 months, but we see a rapid decline in that inner hemispheric connectivity just in the infants who go on to have autism. And on the right, those two plots look different than the one on the left because the ones on the right are only the infants in which we have every time point. So these are truly longitudinal data, where the ones on the left are the infants, it's cross-sectional longitudinal, if you will. So we took every kid that we had at that time point, right? And what you see is that purple line, those infants with TSC who go on to have autism have this rapid reduction in that inner hemispheric connectivity. So what does all this mean, right? So what does alpha do? What does it tell us, right? So, and again, I'm sort of giving you sort of a more kind of reduced version of this just to sort of give you a sense of our story, how we're sort of thinking about this. But alpha really has been shown to reflect robustness of subcortical to cortical connections, right? And it's been shown in many studies to relate directly to white matter development and integrity, right? And it might sort of provide a neural infrastructure for communication between brain regions, which is why it's often been shown to relate to cognitive function across many different developmental populations. And Jamie, I promise I'm almost done. So to steal from kind of Pat Levitt's idea of this idea of balance and the importance of balance of these systems for a typically developing brain, you know, one might sort of think about these infants at familial risk that we're seeing who show increased alpha power. In them, that mechanism of increased alpha might map onto something like early brain overgrowth, like we've seen in some of the imaging work, and early brain early brain expansion, particularly actually in occipital cortex, as the Hazlitt paper recently showed. And we're seeing that increased alpha is most prominent in those infants who develop ASD symptoms. Whereas in TSC, we're seeing a reduction of alpha power, possibly reflective of this delay in white matter development, right, that has been shown in older kids with TSC. And we're also seeing that that's most prominent in the infants who develop autism. But that across the board, in both groups, what we're actually seeing is a disruption in the development of inner hemispheric connectivity, with early overconnectivity followed by a rapid decrease in those with autism symptoms. And so if we want to sort of sum it up, what can we sort of think about this early work? And again, I put all this in an asterisk only because these are small samples, right? And so I think we need to take this with a grain of salt, but also really maybe think about this as a way to frame the way we design future studies. And so I would say that just based on our data, alpha power and coherence as measures of long-range network development might really help us to stratify infants based on autism symptoms across risk groups, but that it might reflect different mechanisms in different risk groups, right? So we really be mindful about how the risk is being defined, right? These trajectories, and we know that in this baby work in general, trajectories are actually been shown to be more predictive, if you will, of outcome than cross-sectional data. Our trajectories might help shed light on mechanism, developmental mechanisms, but that these cross-sectional differences still might be quite valuable as predictive biomarkers. But to really study heterogeneity and to study head-on group comparisons, we need consortia and multi-site studies. And the BSRC has, the Baby SIBS Research Consortium and others have really been talking about ways to do this. So we're not doing one-off studies with small samples, but converging, right, and helping each other really have the power, statistically speaking, right, to do this work in a more meaningful way. And I would finally say that we really need to coordinate these studies and early markers and these natural history studies with early intervention studies, right? Because otherwise, as we're studying these kids, we're missing an opportunity to intervene. And so along those lines, I will say that we're really excited to announce that very recently we received funding received an R01 to actually study the effects of early intervention in infants with TSC. And so we named this, I'm terrible at acronyms, but we finally got one for the study. It's called the JETS study, Jasper Early Intervention for Tuberous Sclerosis. And it's a multi-site study with Boston Children's, Chuck Nelson, and MGH Elizabeth Teal, and then Connie Castry and Amanda Gulstrud at UCLA. And we're basically going to study the effects of Jasper in infants with TSC starting at 12 months. And we'll be examining both electrophysiological changes and predictors of outcome, as well as, you know, our robust behavioral measures to really understand whether we can attenuate some of the symptoms that we see in these infants. And with that, I will stop. Thank you. Oh, okay. And I had my, I had my credit slide at the beginning, so I'll put that back up at the end. And Marilla, I spelled your last name wrong on my credit slide, so I'm apologizing in advance.
Jamie, can we ask questions?
Oh, Chuck. I planted the question. I'm just kidding.
So, Shefali, if I sort of reflect on all the EEG and ERP literature on high-risk babies, there's a sense that sometime between 6 and 12 months, there's this either atypical cortical specialization or the lack of specialization. And actually, April Levin and Carol Wilkinson may even have some data at 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
Neurobiologically, and you have this beautiful marker for this atypical pattern of brain development. Mm-hmm. Neurobiologically, what's pushing the brain in that direction? And why is it being pushed in the direction of autism? Because the model is sort of aberrant development generically, but what specifically leads down the path of autism?
Right. So, you know, to answer sort of the second part of the question first, I would say that I don't know that it's specific to autism, right? That's what we're, you know, we're examining autism symptoms. And one might ask, you know, how specific is, I mean, the ADOS is very specific to autism, but many times our infants who are showing social communication delays are also showing delays in sort of other domains. And I think that with bigger samples, we could start to actually ask the question as to, you know, does the trajectory, for instance, of alpha relate more to certain cognitive domains? So, for instance, in our autism sample, our larger group of children with autism, what we found, and this paper is actually in press, is that alpha actually relates very, and particularly peak alpha relates more strongly in autism to cognitive function, right? And so it's really a marker of just, you're right, like brain development, just basic long-range distributed development. Why 6 to 12 months in particular, I don't have an answer for. I think it's a really good question. And I don't know if it's that where, you know, that's at the age where we're starting to see some synchronization of circuits that we can actually measure these things in a robust enough way, and that if we had more sensitive measures of development at the scalp, we might see similar trajectories earlier on. So it might be a measurement issue as much as anything else. That's it.